time to go out and
jump on. Hey, from the nightclub, edging into springtime at the end of the end of the world. This is Michael C. Rupert, Tracker of Truth, coming to you from a right now very beautiful and sunny San Luis Valley in the Sangre de Cristo Mountains of Colorado, where we had 3 inches of snow last night, but it's a beautiful day outside today. It's not happening in a lot of other places around the world. It's a busy day. There's a lot to talk about and much to do, but I've got some real good stuff for you tonight. The Reverend Martin Niemöller, I'm going to move quickly, wrote about his experience in Nazi Germany. It's one of the most prophetic and well-remembered quotes of all times. First they came for the communists, and I didn't speak out because I wasn't a communist. Then they came for the socialists, and I didn't speak out because I wasn't a socialist. Then they came for the trade unionists, and I didn't speak out because I wasn't a trade unionist. Then they came for the Jews, and I didn't speak out because I wasn't a Jew. Then they came for the Catholics, and I didn't speak out because I wasn't a Catholic. Then they came for me, and there was no one left to speak for me. I just read this to Gary Null before, and I'm going to read this again. I just wrote this tonight because it so applies, especially given the things we're going to hear and talk about. First, it came for the jobs, and I didn't speak out because it wasn't my job. Then it came for the houses, and I did not speak out because it wasn't my house. Then it came for the fresh water, and I did not speak out because they weren't fracking on my land. Then it came for many living things and made them extinct, and I did not speak because I was not yet extinct. Then it came for the climate, and I did not speak out because it was not too uncomfortable for me. And then it came for everything all at once, and there was nothing left to speak anywhere. That's the moment we're at tonight. The big, huge story that went up on my Facebook page, and brother, you better hold on for this. This is from the Associated Press, updated today at 7:39 a.m. I'm assuming that's New York time. Beijing. Chinese officials say they have fished out 900 dead pigs from a Shanghai river that is a water source for city residents. Officials are investigating where the pigs came from. Really? A statement posted Saturday on the city's agricultural committee's website says they haven't found any evidence that the pigs were dumped into the river or of any animal epidemic. George Orwell could not have done better than that. You put 900 pigs in a water supply and let them rot for 3 days, and you are inviting, under natural circumstances, horrendous biological consequences, microbiological consequences. But I'm the guy who also wrote a book called Crossing the Rubicon, The Decline of the American Empire at the End of the Age of Oil, with a whole chapter on biowarfare. And if there were gene-specific man-made bioweapons, which we know are all over the world, this would be an absolutely perfect way to release them. And the truth is, I'm not trying to be alarmist, I'm being a realist, and the truth is, we don't know, and does it make much difference? Can you say pestilence? There's also a video that just went up on my Facebook page. And, you know, I'm going to have to open the page. Things have been happening so fast. So hold on with me while I do this. That is a video talking about prophecies of the end time and doing a spectacular job of documenting recent geologic events such as earthquakes, volcanoes, weather changes, and everything else. Now, it's made by from a Christian perspective, but do not let yourself be prejudiced by that, because as I wrote about the video, it's like what we need to look for are the similarities between the Christian prophecies, the Mayan prophecies, the Hopi prophecies, the Lakota prophecies, the Tibetan prophecies, the Buddhist prophecies, the prophecies of Islam, the prophecies of Judaism. The film is Fidoc Wave, F-I-D-O-C-K, Fidoc Cave, F-I-D-O-C-K-A-V-E. Now I got to back it up a little bit. Fido Cave, here we come. Fido Cave 213. Now that's, I'm sorry, I should have done it, but things have been moving fast. Google that. Fido Cave 213. You'll find it on YouTube as well. It's a very recent video. And most of the stories that they source in there actually, I'm sure it's just a coincidence, but they've all been on my Facebook page in the last 2 to 3 weeks, but they're all packaged together nicely. And we cannot throw out by means of prejudice. Something what we have to look for now is the common thread between all prophecies and new revelations in particle physics, and a lot of physical evidence and science that has been hidden from us, because this stuff, it starts to make sense, especially when you look at the commonality of theme, even to specific detail across all so-called religions. These things are older than what we know as religion. Now, most of you have probably never even heard of a city called Dhaka, D-H-A-K-A, have you? Well, it's funny. It's got more people in Los Angeles, 13, 14 million people. It's a mega city. It's the fastest growing city in Bangladesh. And there was a beautiful story this week in the Toronto Star titled Climate Change Forcing Thousands of Bangladeshi into Slums of Dhaka. Because of massive climate change, this megacity of 13, 14 million people is turning into an absolute hell on earth. The population is expected to be 20 to 30 million by 2050. 12 families using one bathroom that floods, that empties into the street. Now, are you still prepared to say, having never heard of this city called Dhaka, that those people have nothing at all to do with you? Are you prepared to say?
And radical possibility, which is that this emergence into consciousness was triggered by our ancestors' encounters with visionary plants and the beginning of shamanism. If you analyze the cave art, there's not time to go into the details here, but there are so many details that make it clear that this was an art of altered states of consciousness, of visions, that plants like the Amanita muscaria mushroom or psilocybin mushrooms appear to have been directly connected with this sudden and radical change. So to investigate this possibility, when I got interested in this mystery, I went down to the Amazon, where there are still surviving shamanistic cultures today, and where they drink the powerful visionary brew, ayahuasca, of which the active ingredient is dimethyltryptamine, DMT, which is actually closely related at the molecular level to psilocybin. Now, normally, DMT cannot be activated orally. When we encounter it in the West, it's generally smoked. There's an enzyme in our stomachs called monoamine oxidase, which switches off DMT on contact. But in the Amazon, they've got round this problem, and they say it was the spirits that taught them how to do it. The DMT in the ayahuasca brew is contained in these leaves from a plant that they call chacruna in the Amazon. And there they mix it together with this vine. And out of the 150,000 different species of plants and trees in the Amazon, this is the one that contains a monoamine oxidase inhibitor, which switches off that enzyme in our stomachs and allows the DMT in the leaves, when the two are married together and cooked in water, to be absorbed orally, and takes us on a four-hour journey into extraordinary realms. Now, it's no joke to drink ayahuasca. The ayahuasca brew it has a foul taste, really, really hideous, and a dreadful, dreadful smell. And after you've drunk your cup, you'll find within 45 minutes or so that you're sweating, that you're feeling nauseous. Pretty soon you may well be vomiting, you may well have diarrhea. So, you know, nobody's doing this for recreation. And I'd like to add that I don't think any of the psychedelics should be used for recreation. They have much more serious and important mission with humanity. So we're not doing this for fun. But what draws people to ayahuasca again and again to brace themselves for this experience, and you do have to brace yourself, is its extraordinary effects at the level of consciousness. And one of those effects has to do with creativity, and we can see the creative cosmogenic impulse of ayahuasca in the paintings of ayahuasca shamans from Peru, like the paintings of Pablo Amaringo here, those richly saturated colors, the amazing visions that they reproduce. And this creative impulse has also spread to Western artists. Many Western artists now have been deeply influenced by ayahuasca and are also painting their visions. And as these paintings show, another universal experience of ayahuasca is the encounter with seemingly intelligent entities which communicate with us telepathically. Now, I'm making no claim one way or another as to the reality status of these entities we encounter. Simply that phenomenologically, in the ayahuasca experience, they are encountered by people all over the world. And most frequently of all, the spirit of ayahuasca herself, Mother Ayahuasca, who is a healer. And although she's kind of the mother goddess of the planet, she seems to take a direct personal interest in us as individuals, to heal our ills, to want us to be the best that we can possibly be, to correct errors and mistakes in our behavior that may be leading us down the wrong path. And this is perhaps why, and it's an untold story, really. Ayahuasca has been fantastically successful in getting people off harmful addictions to hard drugs such as heroin and cocaine. Jacques Mabit at the Takiwasi Clinic in Peru brings heroin and cocaine addicts out there for a month, gives them 12 ayahuasca sessions, and they have encounters with Mother Ayahuasca during those sessions that lead them not to wish to take heroin or cocaine anymore, and more than half leave completely free of their addiction, never return to it, and don't even have withdrawal symptoms. And the same incredible healing work was being done in Canada by Dr. Gabor Maté until the Canadian government intervened and stopped his healing practice on the grounds that ayahuasca itself was an illegal drug. Now, I have some personal experience of this. I have not been addicted to heroin or cocaine, but I had a 24-year non-stop cannabis habit. And this started off smoking the herb and laterally vaporizing it. But the basic truth is that for 24 years, I was pretty much permanently stoned. And I enjoyed being stoned. And I felt that it helped me with my work as a writer, and perhaps at some point it did. But when I first encountered ayahuasca, I'd already been smoking cannabis for 16 years, and almost immediately, ayahuasca started giving me messages that this was no longer serving me, that it was leading me to behave in negative and unhelpful ways towards others. And of course, I ignored those messages for years and years and went back to being stoned 16 hours a day. But that negative behavior that ayahuasca was pointing up did actually get worse and worse. I don't want to put down cannabis, and I believe it's the sovereign right of every adult to choose to smoke cannabis if they wish to do so. But I think I was overusing it. I think I was abusing it, not using it responsibly. And I became more and more paranoid, jealous, possessive, suspicious. I was subject to irrational rages. I often made the life of my beloved partner, Santha, a misery. And when I went down from my regular encounter with ayahuasca in October 2011, I was given the most unbelievable kicking by Mother Ayahuasca. And I was put through an ordeal. It was a kind of life review. And it's not an accident that ayahuasca is the vine of the dead. I was shown my death, and I was shown that if I came to death and what awaits us after death without having corrected the mistakes that I was making in my life, that it would be a very bad thing to meet for me. And actually, Mother Ayahuasca literally took me to hell. And that hell was a little like this hell painted by Hieronymus Bosch, a truly terrible place, and a little like the place that the ancient Egyptians called the judgment hall of Osiris, where our souls are weighed in the scales in the presence of the gods against the feather of truth, of justice, of cosmic harmony. And I was shown that the path I was walking, my abuse of cannabis and the behavior associated with it, was going to lead me to be found wanting in the judgment, and that I might face annihilation in the world beyond death. So perhaps not surprising that when I came back to England later in October 2011, I gave up cannabis, and I've never smoked it again since then. And actually, and again, I'm speaking only personally with no comment on others' use of cannabis, it's as though a monkey has been lifted off my back. I'm liberated in incredible ways. Far from my creativity being inhibited, I find myself writing much more productively, much more creatively, much more focused, and much more efficiently. As well, and I began to be able to address those negative aspects of my behavior which cannabis had revealed, and hopefully to make myself slowly, it's a long progress, into a more nurturing, more loving, more positive person. And this whole transformation, it really has been a personal transformation for me, was made possible by this encounter with death that Mother Ayahuasca gave me. And, you know, that leads me to ask, what is death? Our materialist science reduces everything to matter. Materialist science in the West says that we are just meat. We're just our bodies. So when the brain is dead, that's the end of consciousness. There is no life after death. There is no soul. We just rot and are gone. But actually, many honest scientists should admit that consciousness is the greatest mystery of science, and that we don't know exactly how it works. The brain's involved in it in some way, but we're not sure how. Could be that the brain generates consciousness the way a generator makes electricity. If you hold to that paradigm, then of course you can't believe in life after death. When the generator's broken, consciousness is gone. But it's equally possible that the relationship, and nothing in neuroscience rules it out, that the relationship is more like the relationship of the TV signal to the TV set. And in that case, when the TV set is broken, of course, the TV signal continues. And this is the paradigm of all spiritual traditions, that we are immortal souls temporarily incarnated in these physical forms to learn and to grow and to develop. And really, if we want to know about this mystery, the last people we should ask are materialist reductionist scientists. They have nothing to say on the matter at all. Let's go rather to the ancient Egyptians, who put their best minds to work for 3,000 years on the problem of death and on the problem of how we should live our lives to prepare for what we will confront after death. And the ancient Egyptians expressed their ideas in transcendent art, which still touches us emotionally today. And they came to certain very specific conclusions, that the soul does survive death, and that we will be held accountable for every thought, every action, every deed that we have lived through in our lives. So we better take this precious opportunity to be born in a human body seriously and make the most of it. And in these inquiries into the mystery of death, the ancient Egyptians weren't just exercising their imaginations. They highly valued dream states, and it's now known that they used visionary plants like the hallucinogenic blue water lily. And it's interesting that the ancient Egyptian tree of life has recently been identified as the Acacia nilotica, which contains high quantities of DMT, dimethyltryptamine, the same active ingredient that we find in ayahuasca. Now, it's difficult to imagine a society more different from the society of ancient Egypt than our society today. We hate visionary states in this society. In our society, if we want to insult somebody, we call them a dreamer. In ancient societies, that was praise. And we have erected huge apparatuses of armed bureaucracies who will invade our privacy, who will break down our doors, who will arrest us, who will send us to prison, sometimes for years, for possessing even small quantities of psilocybin or substances like DMT, whether in its smokable form or in the ayahuasca brew. And yet, ironically, DMT is, as we now know, a natural brain hormone. We all have it in our bodies, and it's just that its function remains unknown for lack of research. And it's not as though our society is opposed in principle to altered states of consciousness. I mean, billions are being made by the unholy alliance of psychiatrists and big pharma in over-prescribing drugs to control so-called syndromes like depression or attention deficit disorder in teenagers. And we have a love affair in our society with alcohol. We glorify this most boring of drugs, despite the terrible consequences that it often has. And of course, we love our stimulants, our tea, our coffee, our energy drinks, our sugar, and huge industries are built around these substances, which are valued because of the way they alter consciousness. But what all these approved altered states of consciousness have in common is that none of them contradict or conflict with the basic state of consciousness valued by our society, which I would call the alert, problem-solving state of consciousness, which is good for the more mundane aspects of science. It's good for the prosecution of warfare. It's good for commerce. It's good for politics. But I think everybody realizes that the promise of a society over-monopolistically based upon this state of consciousness has proved hollow. and that this model is no longer working, that it's broken in every possible sense that a model can be broken, and that urgently we need to find something to replace it. The vast problems of global pollution that have resulted from the single-minded pursuit of profit, the horrors of nuclear proliferation, the specter of hunger, that millions every night go to bed starving, that we can't even solve this problem despite our alert problem-solving state of consciousness. And look what's happening in the Amazon, the lungs of our planet, this precious home of biodiversity. The old-growth rainforest being cut down and replaced with soybean farms so we can feed cattle, so that we can all eat hamburgers. Only a truly insane global state of consciousness could allow such an abomination to occur. And I did a back-of-an-envelope calculation during the Iraq War. It seems to me that 6 months' expenditure on the Iraq War would have solved the problem of the Amazon forever, would be sufficient to compensate the peoples of the Amazon so that no single tree ever needed to be cut down again to garden and look after that amazing resource. But we can't make that decision as a global community. We can spend countless billions on warfare, on hatred, on fear, on suspicion, on division, but we can't get together the collective effort to save the lungs of our planet. And this is perhaps why shamans from the Amazon are now mounting a kind of reverse missionary activity. When I've asked shamans about the sickness of the West, they say it's quite simple. You guys have severed your connection with spirit. Unless you reconnect with spirit and do so soon, you're going to bring the whole house of cards down around your heads and ours. And rightly or wrongly, they believe that ayahuasca is the remedy for that sickness. And many now are being called to the Amazon to drink ayahuasca, and ayahuasca shamans are traveling throughout the West, offering the brew, often under the radar, often at personal risk, to bring about consciousness change. And it's true that the message of ayahuasca, the universal message, is about the sacred, magical, enchanted, infinitely precious nature of life on Earth, and the interdependence of material and spiritual realms. And it's impossible to work with ayahuasca for long without being deeply and profoundly affected by this message. And let's not forget that ayahuasca is not alone, that it's part of an ancient worldwide system of the targeted, careful, responsible alteration of consciousness. It's recently been shown by scholars that the kaikion used in the Eleusinian mysteries in ancient Greece was almost certainly a psychedelic brew, that the soma of the Vedas may well have been a brew based upon the Amanita muscaria mushroom. We have the DMT in the ancient Egyptian tree of life. We have the whole global culture of surviving shamanism, and what it's all about is a state of consciousness that's designed to help us find balance, harmony. The ancient Egyptians would have called it mart, with the universe, and to remain mindful that what we're here to undertake on Earth while immersed in matter is fundamentally a spiritual journey aimed at the growth and perfection of the soul, a journey that may go back to the very origins of what made us human in the first place. And I stand here invoking the hard-won right of freedom of speech to call for and demand another right to be recognized, and that is the right of adult sovereignty over consciousness. There's a war on consciousness in our society, and if we as adults are not allowed to make sovereign decisions about what to experience with our own consciousness while doing no harm to others, including the decision to use responsibly ancient and sacred visionary plants, then we cannot claim to be free in any way. And it's useless for our society to go around the world imposing our form of democracy on others while we nourish this rot at the heart of society and we do not allow individual freedom over consciousness. It may even be that we're denying ourselves the next vital step in our own evolution by allowing this state of affairs to continue, and who knows, perhaps our immortal destiny as well. Thank you.
Bravo, Grant. Graham Hancock, thank you. Thank you so much. Let me give you a quote. The quote is from what is known in spiritual circles as the Gnostic Christ. It comes from the Dead Sea Scrolls. Much of Christianity's truths have been thrown out and or suppressed. But here's a quote which applies. If you bring forth what is within you, what you bring forth will save you. If you do not bring forth what is within you, what you do not bring forth will destroy you. the Gnostic Christ. There are many views to life, and Graham Hancock was talking about our liberty and ability to find and face those things. This is Michael C. Rupert, Tracker of Truth, on the Lifeboat Hour at Progressive Radio Network. We will be back right after these messages. Do not go away. Glitch. That was the amazing Diane Patterson, who took us into and out of the break with the vibration, the frequency we want. Boy, that song is still important. I haven't played Diane in a while just because I didn't want to overuse her. I wanted to save her for kind of like the really poignant moments. And Diane, if you're out there, I hope you're doing really good. All right, Charles Eisenstein has been a guest on this show twice, author of Sacred Economics, who I quoted in my September 11, 2011 speech in Portland, Oregon. Who's one of the many bright lights that shine in the movie Occupied Cascadia, is coming to Boulder, Colorado, April 12th through the 14th. Now, this is up on Facebook, and you can find it on Facebook under Charles Eisenstein in Boulder, April 12th. You'll find it on Facebook. I was looking for it elsewhere on the web, and I know that you will find the other details. It's a three-day event, and I'm going for two of the days for sure. I am not going to miss that. I want to be amongst all the amazing energy that's going to be crowded surrounding that event. Carolyn Baker is going to be there, and I know some just all these refreshing proofs of the existence of Gaian consciousness flourishing are going to be gathered there in Boulder, and I'm going. You'll probably find more details at Charles's website, realitysandwich.com, realitysandwich.com. That's Charles Eisenstein's site. I'm sure that all the information on how to go, how to attend, and everything will be there. If not, you can find it on Facebook, and if somebody gets a better link, put it on my Facebook page. We'll get it out one way or the other. Anyway, I strongly recommend that. Okay, back to this show and this amazing day. I mean, this amazing week. If you haven't gotten it yet, it's kind of apparent that there is a shift in consciousness taking place, because we are seeing so much evidence that a different consciousness is emerging. This is the consciousness which I have called the Gaian consciousness. That would include all of Native American and indigenous spirituality, all of the people who have held the traditions of Mother Earth for the last 5,300 or so years, all of the Christian sects and the Western knowledge from Egypt and Greece that has been suppressed, all sharing in common the same thing. That consciousness, all of those things I lump into Gaian consciousness, our recognition that we are on one living planet, that we are all connected to each other, that there is only one life, and that is the change in consciousness which must be achieved, and that is the change in consciousness which Graham Hancock just so eloquently told you is being fought over. Now, I don't know about you, but I get a sense that we're gaining ground. Now, if you happen to live, I put these up earlier in the week. What a week. What a week. We ain't even done with all the stuff that's going on. Big Ugly Stink in Santa Monica. In case you haven't heard, it's from March 4th. Here's the short version of the story. It was widely reported in L.A., for 2 days in the Santa Monica Bay, which was home base for me. I used to sing at the Boathouse Restaurant on the Santa Monica Pier. It's now a place called Bubba Gum Shrimp Company. There was a natural release of methane from the seabed floor so intense that it prompted a flood of 911 calls, 911 calls. You know, hey, there's a gas leak, but I mean, we're talking hundreds of calls throughout West LA and Santa Monica. Now, that is an unnatural occurrence. Those are methane hydrates. That's a sign of a major seismic shift underneath the seafloor, often associated as a precursor to a major earthquake. And I really strongly suggest you go find that prophecy video. I'm sorry I gave the name earlier. It was a great video. I didn't put it in my notes. that was compiled about all the geologic and seismic events that are taking place around the world. This at a time when other signs are pointing to a change in popes, which will happen right before, and guess what? We're in one of those. It is in the weaving of the commonality and seeing the consistency, or as David Wilcock might say, the coherence of pieces of information, tuning into those frequencies, that we find that there is much more truth available than we've been led to believe. And certainly with 900 pigs floating in the Shanghai water supply, I mean, it's nasty. So, as bad as everything looks, I struggled to find a song. I didn't struggle. Actually, I found about five or six that are now in a file that I'm waiting on. But I chose one particular song. It's an extremely personal song to me because it came out in 1970, the same year as the shooting at Kent State, and I was a sophomore on the UCLA campus. I think it was May 12, 1970, the day those shootings occurred. And there was an album that was, like, absolutely owned the airwaves on that day when the world seemed to be so grossly and horribly disturbed, disfigured, and in agony. And it was by some guys, one of whom in particular, Stephen Stills, was an enormous influence on me musically and my singing style, and who I just adored. But there were some people in the group named David Crosby, Graham Nash, Neil Young, and the album was Deja Vu. And this is a time, and this is where I've spoken in the last several shows about my spiritual revelation about the knife edge. On the one hand, we hold the crises in our consciousness, which is one side of the blade. We hold all of this tragedy that is taking place, all of this stuff that is so horrific and getting worse. We hold that on one side, but we also hold on the other side our hope, our faith, our heart's desire, not our brain's desire, but our heart's desire for a world of peace. And 1970 was a very dark time. I mean, Vietnam was a raging, and yet something happened. And the song is called, and this is what I would say to all of us right now, we don't give up, we carry on. Here it is, Carry On.
One morning I woke up and I knew it was all. A new day, a new way, a new life.
About you, but I needed that. Now, Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, the song is Carry On from 1970, the great album Deja Vu. Thank you, brothers. That was good. Our generation is not dead yet, is it? No, we're still here. We're still trying to wave the flag. Okay, so in the midst of all the other stuff that's going on, I caught this off of Facebook, and again, thanks to all my Facebook friends, especially Robin Westender and Lee Deathcare Nelson and everybody who's just finding this great stuff. Our conscience. Nobody is as smart as all of us, and that's nobody is as smart as all of us. And boy, I'm beginning to see that that energetic accelerate. Cash-strapped Egypt considers offering pyramids and other monuments, i.e., the Sphinx, for rent. Now, it's one way to look at that. Oh, well, okay, that's just everything else going to shit in a handbasket. And I stop and I think about the writings of the Graham Hancocks, the David Wilcox, the stuff from Greg Braden, all of the stuff, and which meshes perfectly with the latest research in particle physics from Michio Kaku, that Greg Braden brings you, gets all the great names that are out there, Amit Goswami, you know, all of these guys who are telling us that consciousness, frequency, thought determines physical reality. But now this knowledge has been stored in places like the pyramids, great connections to that between pyramids all over the world along grid lines. And in South America, and enormous suppressed evidence of the fact that there's been a lot of things that have been systematically hidden from our consciousness for 5,000-6,000 years. Now, if Egypt's running those out, and they do contain access to some kind of technology or wisdom, do we not worry about who might be moving to try to keep the control of human consciousness? It's just a thought, but what the heck? You know, the more our minds can pry open, the more effective we can be. And that's just critical to understand right now. Now, I want to spend the last few minutes talking about Hugo Chavez. In 2006, after my computers were smashed in Ashland, Oregon, and as I was being set up on sexual harassment charges, and we just published part five of the Pat Tillman series, and I had just published my fourth ever economic alert, totally outing the Bush administration for deliberately creating the collapse, the rewriting of bankruptcy laws, and the exemption of major banks on Wall Street from reporting on national security grounds. Horseshit. And I was firing at Bush Cheney with both barrels, and it was clear my life was in danger, and it was imperative to keep the Tillman series alive. Computers smashed, and realizing that my life here was going down, I realized that if I stayed alive, that kept the series going. So I went to Venezuela very quickly. I had made a visit to the consulate in San Francisco and just said, hey, this is who I am, this is what's going on, and let them know that I might be coming. They apparently did not understand that that would be very soon. The following week, I took a flight out of Tijuana and flew to Caracas, Venezuela, where I spent 4 months in exile. I asked for asylum, didn't get it. I was promised a meeting with Nicolas Maduro, who is now running for president. The good things that happened were Ava Golinger, a great author and a very brave woman, had me on state radio, and she befriended me, as did a few other people down there who saved my life. I was poisoned down there, and I came back. But I got to feel Venezuela, and I went there because Hugo Chavez, who had at that time won four elections while George Bush had stolen two, who had survived a CIA corporate coup, who through the Venezuelan National Oil Company, Citgo, was delivering heating oil for free to needy families in the Northeast United States, and whose main crime was that he said, as a Bolivarian socialist, not a communist, but as a Bolivarian socialist, that South America's resources belonged to South American people. What a novel concept. South America, the raping playground of the Rockefeller family and corporate America for 100 years, where the CIA forced Salvador Allende and Goulart in Brazil to commit suicide after coups and revolts, where all manner of unspeakable atrocities have been committed in the name of your Coca-Cola and bananas and whatever. Chavez stood up and told it like it was, and he survived the coup attempts, and he was a warrior, and I went there. Now, he didn't touch me. I never got, you know, was never contacted officially, really, by the Venezuelan government, and I think he didn't want to contaminate me, so that if and when I came back, which I did after Donald Rumsfeld was outed in Tillman, I would be uncontaminated. He could ship me, put me in a railroad car, if you will, as the Germans did with Lenin, and send him to Russia. You could say Chavez could send me home. I don't know, but I have the man deserves enormous respect. He fought a fight against cancer that was one of the bravest struggles I have ever seen in my life. And yes, I do believe that that cancer was CIA induced. If you don't believe that that stuff happens, then go look at the Church Pike hearings into CIA operations. Go look at what was revealed about attempts to give Fidel Castro cancer and to develop weaponized cancer. Yes, I do believe that he was poisoned, just as I was down there, not with the cancer causing, but was shutting down my adrenals and all my lymph system. I was passing out on the street. It was, and the Cuban doctors couldn't tell me what I was poisoned with. But anyway, Hugo Chavez died this week, and I say totally, especially because of his enormous cojones. Rest in peace, man. You were a dude. I don't worship you, but you have earned more respect and respect from your people and the people of Latin America. And I so hope that Hillary Clinton, now John Kerry's State Department and the CIA and all of the corporate money that is moving around down there do not get control. And I'm seeing the signs very, very clearly, and I believe this is true, that Hugo Chavez's death will be an inspiration to all the people of Latin America to fight for their neighborhood. Because if the people of Latin America cannot have their neighborhood, then I cannot have mine. Because if we do not see that all of these tragedies happening around the world are happening to each and every one of us, there will not be an opportunity, a chance, a time to achieve the change in consciousness which is essential for these crises to be resolved or even survived. And Graham Hancock was so on the money. And as you listen to him talk just about the different uses of intoxicants and why they're banned and so forth to change consciousness, but doesn't it become clear that we have, if we are imprisoned in the way we think, we also have the key to freedom instantly available to us. Instantly. When the light bulb goes on, when you realize how deep in a ham and eggs breakfast, the chicken is involved, but the pig is committed. Once your consciousness becomes a pig to understanding how important it is to leave behind fear and separation, it will happen. And when the 100th monkey arrives, that's what will happen then. That's what I've been trying to say here, and Graham Hancock just said it so amazingly. I put up a comment on Facebook, and maybe I'll close with this tonight. I was talking about biblical references as opposed to, you know, Native American, Mayan, Tibetan, whatever. And it was a discussion about that, and it reminded me of so much of my speech in Portland, Oregon, on September 11. And I put this comment up on Facebook. I have known of all of the biblical references for at least 25 years. I can only climb on with this, and it was a video which left one at the conclusion that the world is over, that the world has ended, but that's only if you buy one concept. So I wrote, I can only climb on with this by offering my own truth about God. God, whatever you understand God to be, just so long as you know it's not you. In my speech in Portland, Oregon, I specifically and publicly spat on the God Jehovah and called it a false God. I did that from the pulpit of a large church. That is the God that wrote that mankind had dominion over the planet, that man's job was to subdue, exploit, and plunder Mother Earth. That was the God that created a false sense of division between us, you and me, and the Mother Earth that is us. I spat on the God that took man out of the human, out of the Garden of Eden. I spat on the God that said that women were inferior to men. I spat on the God that ruled over a universe of duality and controlled by fear. My knowing as tracker of truth is that Jehovah has only ruled for about the last 5,300, 5,400 years. My knowing is that it was Jehovah who brought us fear and imprisoned us in it. My knowing is that Jehovah is a much lesser God. We are children of the lesser God. My knowing is that this lesser God is waging a losing battle for control of human consciousness. So I absolutely do not arrive at the same place that this clip leads me to. I am hopeful, I am cheerful, because what this clip does is to tell me that human consciousness is actually seeing what this old God is, that human consciousness is becoming aware of a deeper reality. That is the surest sign of the old paradigms, the memes, Jehovah's, whatever you want to call it, an infinite growth. That is the surest sign of its impending demise, because once it is seen, human consciousness becomes and is the irresistible power to remove it from our experience. Fear or love? Fear or love? I went to a great Inipi sweat lodge on Friday, and it was a very powerful experience. And in the third round, the rocks, many spirits, many bright lights popped from the rocks and floated and hung around the ceiling, and some healings came as a result of that. And it was a great reminder that we are and can be reborn if we choose to reborn. And I'm not talking fundamentalist Christian, you know that. We can re-achieve that connectedness, and that connectedness, that change, that consciousness that we are connected, is the only thing that will save us. So, you know what? I have the feeling the 100th monkey was listening tonight. This is Michael C. Rupert, Tracker of Truth, on the Lifeboat Hour on the Progressive Radio Network. We'll be back next week, but take very close attention, because things are happening quickly. See you then.
Do you want to know the latest news or upcoming events? Follow us at Twitter at PRN_radio.